My name is Marcus Casey, and I am a volunteer meditation instructor here at Columbus KTC. Here at KTC, we are fortunate to have more than one lama, actually, two resident lamas, which is very unique among centers. So we receive wonderful teachings from our lamas, but we do need to share the wealth from time to time, and so Lama Kathy is sometimes away at other KTCs or at our home monastery in New York, and Lama Tom, we share him with Athens KTC, and he's here on every fourth Sunday. So when there is a Sunday that neither of our lamas are here, Lama Kathy has asked Eric Weinberg and Kathy Jackson and myself to teach and do some book studies while while they're away. So we usually are going through a book by one of our lineage masters, and the book we've been working our way through for a few weeks now is called Meditation: Advice to Beginners by Bokar Rinpoche. And he's one of the revered meditation masters in the Kagyu lineage. Now, this book is out of print, but we do have an electronic copy that we've been working from, so that's why we've got printed out versions of it. But it's a fantastic book and really very, very in-depth instruction on meditation, and so we really feel like it's worth going through, even though we can't offer it in our bookstore, for example. Now, the first few chapters have covered many topics related to starting a meditation practice, a lot of the hows and the whys and things like that, especially related to shamatha or calm abiding meditation. Now, this week this chapter that we're going through this week is about what keeps us from our practice, what hinders our meditation. And it really applies to shamatha or whatever your practice is. So there are three attitudes or fallacies, mistakes that we make in our meditation and in our motivation to meditation. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Now, we traditionally start with the four-line refuge prayer at the beginning of all of our talks. Now, the prayer is in Tibetan, and I know some of you may know it, some of you do not. If you are not familiar with this prayer, then feel free to just kind of listen and give yourself a moment to relax and let go of cares and worries, and to also make the aspiration that others are able to be free from their cares and worries as well. So we'll repeat the prayer three times. Om Sangje Chidang Sogyi Chognam La Jiang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dai Jin So Ji Pe Su Nam Yi Dro La Pen Chir Sang Je Du Par Sho Sang Je Chi Dang So Ki Cho Nam La Jiang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Kyab Su Chi Dagi jin so ki pe su nam yi Dro la pen chir sang je du par sho Sang je chi dang so ki cho nam la Jiang chu bar du dai ni kyab su chi Dagi jin so ji pe su nam yi Dro la pen chir sang je du par sho. Thank you very much. Now, you may need to bear with me a little bit. This is my first time doing a Dharma talk here. I have taught the intro classes upstairs, but this is a new experience for me. And given the value of the teachings I have received during these Dharma talks over the years, and the importance they've played in my life, it's daunting to now be up here and be in front of you. So when Lama Kathy asked me to do this, I admit I had some doubts. And have you heard of the imposter syndrome? Right? Yeah, so it's that gnawing fear that you're not good enough for something and will be exposed as a fraud, right? So I admit I had some of those feelings when I was asked to do this. But I took a look at the chapter that was scheduled for today, and it was all about what's hindering your meditation and what's causing your meditation to get off track. And I thought, well, I'm an expert at getting off track. I can talk about this one. So we should be good. I have personal experience with all three of these hindrances. In all seriousness, this is a fantastic topic because Bokar Rinpoche is really examining where our motivation goes wrong and how to fix it. It starts off with a really key statement that he makes. He says, "Meditation is recognizing the nature of the mind. This recognition is the most important task that we must accomplish." Now, this first sentence is really powerful because it talks about the reason we meditate, or the ultimate goal of meditation, and that is to recognize the nature of the mind. And the second sentence says that fulfilling that goal, the goal of meditation, recognizing the nature of the mind, is the most important task we must accomplish. So he's giving us both the purpose of meditation and the importance of meditation in that statement. The purpose of meditation is to recognize the nature of the mind. And if you'll notice, Bokar Rinpoche does not say that this is the most important task that we will accomplish in our spiritual lives, or that this is the most important task that we will accomplish when we come to the meditation center, or in meditation. What he is telling us here is that the recognition of the mind, of the nature of the mind, is the task of our lives. It is our way out of the cycle of suffering. So our topic today is recognizing the reasons we lose our motivation to meditate. And what it all boils down to is that we lose the realization that this is so important, that this is the most important task of our lives. And we'll kind of work through these, all three. There are three hindrances that we're going to be talking about. And as we work through them, one of the fascinating things I find about Buddhism, one of the things I love about it, is it kind of has a nice formula to it in the way it offers a lot of these teachings. It gives you what's wrong. It tells you what the solution is, and then it gives you practical ways of getting from where you are to the solution. And so we're going to have contemplations to talk about, things to really think about and chew on, and hopefully not just while we're sitting here today, but hopefully through our week you can examine your meditation practice, examine what keeps you off the cushion, examine what discourages you, things like that, and come back to these three hindrances and see if they make sense for you. So the three hindrances are attachment to the world, lack of confidence, and distraction. We'll go in depth, but I can see smiles. Some people are already recognizing themselves in some of these, right? Just by mentioning it. So the problem is that our meditation is being hindered from leading us to the realization of the nature of the mind. The solution is to first weaken and then eventually get rid of our attachment to the world, our lack of confidence, and our distraction. And the rest of the teaching now will be to discuss these in detail. So we have I'm sure you've all heard the Four Noble Truths, that attachment causes our suffering. And what is at the root of a lot of that attachment is a primary error in our thinking. We are convinced that our reality is permanent, real, and unchanging. Now, that may not be a conscious thought. And if you've been hanging around here enough, you've heard Lama Kathy and others make the statement that it's not. So if I said, okay, who here thinks that phenomena are permanent, real, and unchanging, I might not get a lot of hands raised. But the question is, how deeply is that, has that been implanted in our thinking, in our thought processes, and in our daily lives? So we may not have fully internalized that. So Rinpoche breaks this down into three things to contemplate. The first is impermanence. The second is the mistaken belief that phenomena can bring us happiness. And the third is our mistaken belief in the self-existence of phenomena. So those are heavy topics. Let's just dive right in. Impermanence. We have to get rid of the preconception that objects that we perceive, including our bodies, are permanent and unchanging. All phenomena change from one instance to another. They are transitory by their very nature. Now, we have a tendency to project onto things, onto reality, onto ourselves, a solidity and a reality that they just don't actually have. And it's beyond the scope of this talk to fully dive into the Buddhist philosophy of emptiness, and probably beyond my qualifications as well. But briefly, entertain the idea that if a thing is changing from one moment to the next, there is never a moment when we can truly point to something and say, this is what it is. Because the moment we do that, it's already changed. If you look at your own body, now we have a tendency to think of our bodies as being very solid, very real. We often have a tendency to think of them as being permanent, although we know they aren't, right? So we wouldn't say this consciously, but in truth, if you really think about what your body is, about all the parts that make up the body, all the cells and molecules that go into your body and how they are in motion, they are being born, they are dying, these small cells and small parts of your body. The fact is that moment to moment, our bodies are not the same. There has been change going on since the moment we were born, and they will continue to change until we die and our bodies decay. And the same thing is true of objects, the objects we interact with around us. This building, for example. Now, I know this building's over 100 years old, but the building is constantly changing. Not just, I mean, yes, you get new carpet, you get all these type things are very obvious changes, but what we don't really see, what we don't really notice, unless you look over a long period of time, are the small degradations, small changes that happen moment to moment in things. So this doesn't happen, you know, in a way that we can notice. And maybe that's why we tend to overlook it. The fact that our bodies or this building are in a constant process of modification. But when we take the long view and we look at it, we can begin to realize how futile it is to grasp onto these things that are constantly changing. If everything is in flux, if literally everything around us is in flux, if instead of existing in, you know, a painting that's still and not moving, and we like to think of it that way, right? Everything's not going to change, and you get things just so. You make things, you adjust your reality so that things are more pleasant. But the truth is, we're not living in a painting. And the better metaphor probably is a stream, right? Everything around us is moving and changing, and we are too. And grasping on to things that are themselves moving and changing is always going to cause us difficulty. When we become too attached to our bodies as it relates to meditation, there's very often a tendency to think, "Yeah, I'm tired right now. I'm not going to meditate." Or when it's objects, you know, you sit down and your mind just keeps returning to this thing you want, this thing you want, this thing you want, this thing you just got, whatever it is. Or you spend time playing with your new toy, whatever it is, instead of getting to the cushion, right? So there are lots of ways that this attachment can stand in the way of us getting to the cushion and working on recognizing the true nature of the mind. And that kind of flows very naturally into the next contemplation that Bokhar Rinpoche mentions here, and that is that phenomena cannot bring us happiness. In addition to our mistake of seeing the outer world as impermanent, we also see phenomena as having the capacity to bring us happiness. And this simply is not true. We look for happiness in beautiful sights, forms, sounds, tastes. And if we look at that carefully, we realize that those things are never going to actually come through for us. We already talked about how those things are always changing and how they're going to have a hard time fulfilling our happiness if one minute they are a way we wanted them to be and the next minute they are not. So if we look for happiness in our jobs, we need to understand that that job will change. If we look for happiness in our relationships, understand that each of those relationships will change. Ed Powers, longtime member of this community, is the one who first said, every marriage ends in death or divorce. Right? And death is the preferred manner, right? we're actually grasping onto those relationships is always going to let us down. Excuse me. And the list just goes on, and it changes week to week for all of us. One week it may be a new car or house, entertainment, food, you know, then you get the car, and then the next week it's something else. And so, in truth, the happiness of one moment, because of impermanence, can become the unhappiness of the next moment. And take, for example, buying a new car, right? You get the new car. You're totally excited about it. You wash it, you wax it, you take care of it. First time you drive it to work, somebody dings it with their door, right? And then suddenly your mind is just totally, you're frustrated, you're angry, you're trying to figure out how to get that fixed in a way that it's like new again, and you're trying to return to that state. And the fact is that that's just the first of many ways that that car is going to let you down. Over time, it's going to break down. You're going to get tired of it. It's going to get out of date. At some point, it might not even be compatible with your phone anymore. So, I mean, you know, all kinds of problems with your new car down the road. Bokar Rinpoche says that one can say that a moment of happiness is not really happiness because it's never definitive. And this is the reason the Buddha gave us the metaphor that he gave us that makes me cringe and shiver every time. And that is that happiness and the pleasure of this world can be compared to honey on the edge of a razor, to licking honey on the edge of a razor. Because at first you appreciate the sweetness of the honey, but then you get cut and you feel the pain. And we like to pretend that that pain is not behind there, even if we know it ultimately will be. Now, we started this talk with a recitation of the four-line refuge prayer. And refuge is the entry ceremony, really, to becoming a Buddhist, and has been since the time of the Buddha. And what we're doing when we take refuge is that we are taking refuge in that which is outside of the cycle of suffering. So we are actually reorienting ourselves from this pattern of looking for our happiness in things that will let us down, in things that are actually also themselves always changing and part of this cycle of suffering. We are instead reaching out to the teachings and those who can lead us to the example set by the Buddha that will lead us out of that cycle of suffering. So, reorienting our minds away from this mistaken belief that the phenomena can bring us happiness is really a step that we all have taken, and those of us who have taken it in the taking the refuge vow, it's helpful to repeat that. And it's helpful to contemplate all the other things we're taking refuge in that are not that. Because that's really what it's talking about here, is the if we're looking to phenomena to make us happy, we're taking refuge in those things. And they are not going to come through for us. So the third contemplation then is the lack of self-existence of phenomena. In order to conquer attachment to this world, including to our bodies and material objects, it is first necessary to rid ourselves of the mistaken belief that they have a real and independent existence. And this is where things can get a little bit sticky and a little bit tough. Bokar Rinpoche says, although we accord a self-existence to phenomena of the external world, they are lacking this reality and are only manifestations projected by our own mind. He gives the example of a dream. Now, we all know that the objects of a dream don't exist. As much as they feel like they exist at the time we are experiencing the dream, when we wake up, we realize that none of it was real. But we had real emotions during that dream, right? We reacted in that dream according to what objects, what not real objects, not real circumstances were going on. But once we wake up, we realize that was just the play of our minds. and even the emotions that arose as a result were just as a result of the play of our minds. So our great masters who have awakened tell us that it is the same for the appearances that we are seeing in our day-to-day life when we are physically awake, when we are not asleep. So even if it's difficult for us to experience, we can understand how qualities we attribute to the external world are in fact colored by our minds. Bokar Rinpoche gives the example of when our life circumstances, when our minds are really troubled, even if we go to a great restaurant and we're with friends that we love, the food's going to taste terrible and we might not have a good time, right? And on the other hand, if we are just ecstatic and just got great news, we can go to a mediocre restaurant and love the experience and love the food. As I read this, I got to thinking about all those reviews we spend time reading on Amazon and things like that, and how much stock we put into them, and how there's also an element of that being a function of the life circumstance of the person who was writing that review at the time, as well as the object itself, right? The idea, though, is that our reality is so colored by the current emotions and the current flow of our minds that in a lot of ways we can't really trust that either. I think of the bumper sticker that I've seen around here that says, don't believe everything you think. You can't always trust your mind to be telling you exactly the truth. And when I say you can't always trust your mind, I'm not talking about your true mind. I'm talking about your mind as we experience it with all kinds of obscurations. Bokar Rinpoche says, understanding that everything is impermanent, that happiness is transformed into suffering, and that all phenomena are lacking reality in themselves and are only projections of our mind, will permit us to counteract the first hindrance of meditation, our attachment to this world. Now, the second, that was just number one. The second hindrance to our meditation is lack of confidence. And what he's talking about here is lack of confidence in the Dharma or our teacher. So the teachings and our teacher. I had the privilege recently of being part of a series organized by an interfaith group here in Columbus. And the purpose of this series was to foster interfaith dialogue. So every month, they had a member of a different religion give a talk to the whole group. So the night I went, the talk was given by Glenn at the Center for Pragmatic Buddhism. And so this was the Buddhism night, right? So they had a Buddhist Zen teacher give a talk. And then everyone split up to their own table after his talk. And there was supposed to be at least one Buddhist at every table. So I was the representative Buddhist at my table. And one of the fascinating conversations we had was watching the people who were there learn how faith is treated in Buddhism. Because it's quite different than the definitions they've worked with. And it was a lot of people, they said, oh, that's beautiful. I love that. When we talk about faith in Buddhism, we're talking about confidence. And we're talking about a development of confidence over time. We're talking about Lama Kathy uses the phrase, and I love this phrase, entertain the notion. So you come on something in Buddhism that's a step too far for you. And Lama Kathy will say, entertain the notion. Try it on. Work with it. If it doesn't work for you, you can save it for another time. But there's really the idea of trying on the things our teachers are teaching us. And Bokar Rinpoche gives the example of choosing a doctor, a patient going to a doctor. So someone gets sick. He's looking for a doctor. Someone tells him, hey, I know this good doctor. You should go see this good doctor. So the guy goes to see the good doctor. The doctor diagnoses him, gives him the medicine. He goes away, and he feels better. So the next time he starts feeling bad, he's going to have more confidence in that doctor. Maybe it's something more serious, but he knows that doctor knows what he's doing and has already treated him before. And that's the same type of confidence that we talk about when we talk about faith in our tradition. You start hearing these teachings, you start your daily meditation practice, and you dip your toe in, you meditate for a while, and you start noticing differences. You start noticing your ability to stop that cycle of that kind of gets you spiraling out of control into negative thinking. And just once or twice off the cushion, you were able to just kind of let that settle and go about your day. And you realize, hey, this stuff really works. And so you go a little deeper and a little deeper. And that's all that's really ever asked of you, is to grow in confidence and keep trying that on. Now, this only actually works if you are actually doing the meditation and you're doing the work, right? You can sit here and hear assessments of how the mind works. And it can really, I mean, a lot of us, this was one of the first moments that really attracted us to come here. We hear talk about how the mind works and we say, yeah, that really fits with my experience. But if you're really going to grow in confidence, you're going to have to do more than just keep hearing people talk. You're going to need to experience it for yourself. Now, you can't just walk away and expect to go meditate for 3 days and I didn't get enlightened, and so you, or my mind was all over the place, I'm a bad meditator, boom, drop it, right? So that's not exactly going to work. This is something that works over time, but it has been my experience that the more you practice and the more you entertain the notion and push yourself a little deeper and a little deeper, the more you're going to find that will increase your confidence and become true. So, what Bokar Rinpoche is saying is that whether or not we acknowledge it, if we are not growing in confidence, then it can stagnate and we can kind of lose our motivation. If we don't keep pushing ourselves and have that daily practice and have that regular meditation, we're going to think it's not working, and then it's going to kind of self-reinforce our spotty meditation practice. So, and the third hindrance is a mind that is constantly distracted by external objects. These distractions could be related to the past, the present, or the future, but Bokar Rinpoche says most of the time it's going to be the past or the future. And he points out that when our minds are preoccupied with the past, Most of the time, it's not the good things in the past, right? Most of the time, when we have our minds spinning on the past, we're thinking about some kind of suffering, some kind of mistake we made, something we wish someone else had done differently. And Bokar Rinpoche says, we can't undo the past. Let us leave it alone. With our thoughts, we create useless suffering about events that no longer exist. I saw one time, and I looked online for the source of this quote, and I found it attributed to about five different people, so who knows, but I saw a definition of forgiveness, and that was that forgiveness is letting go of the hope for a better past. And we spend a lot of time doing that, don't we? For many of us, our thoughts dwell on the future more than the past. And again, a lot of times, we've got this negative future out there built for ourselves. It may be positive. Maybe you're excited about something, or maybe you're saying, well, in the future, things will be better than they are now. So, you know, there are a lot of ways we can really fantasize about what's coming up. And Rinpoche says that the problem with this is that we don't enjoy the peace of the present moment, and instead we substitute it for suffering a situation that does not exist. And our illusory thoughts are really phenomena. The future, for the moment, is not here at all, but we turn toward it in order to suffer. We all do it. And he says that even though we could think about the future either in a favorable or unfavorable way, we usually think about it unfavorably, and obviously we experience a lot of worry and anxiety as a result. Rinpoche says, if we look at the present without turning toward the past or future, in general, we simply do not have any suffering. When we are meditating, if we don't follow thoughts related to the past or future and instead maintain a relaxed mind, just as it is in the present moment, there's no suffering. Now, Rinpoche talks about two fallacies that we tend to make when we are meditating. And the first one is mechanically following thoughts that arise. And I'm sure we've all experienced that. The second one, and one that is a little more subtle and a little easier to make without realizing you're making it, is that you're trying to stop thoughts from arising. And he says that's a fallacy. That is not what we're supposed to do. He said the correct view is to be aware of the production of thoughts, but neither to stop them or to follow them, simply to not worry about them. If we aren't worried, if we aren't preoccupied with our thoughts, they don't have any strength. If we don't grasp after them, they don't have any strength. And then he gives this fantastic metaphor that I have had at the forefront of my mind ever since I was reading this and preparing this talk. He talks about the ocean and the waves on the surface of the ocean. And he says, now we can think of waves and we can think of the ocean as being two different things. But in their essence, they are the same. They're both just the water, right? The waves rise on the surface of the ocean and then go right back into the ocean. Now, if we're at the ocean and we see these waves coming in, there's no point in grabbing every wave and trying to do something with it. We don't have any responsibility to manage these waves. We also don't need to look at the ocean and say, these waves need to calm down and be perfectly still. The metaphor here is that our minds are the ocean and the thoughts are the waves on the surface of the ocean. They are, in essence, of the same stuff. There is no difference in essence between our minds and the thoughts that arise in our minds. Similarly, we don't have to chase down every thought that rises up and run with it. Neither do we have to try to get all those thoughts to settle and go away. First of all, it's not going to happen. And in sticking with the metaphor, Bokha Rinpoche says, we can just sit on the beach and relax. We can let those waves come and then settle back in. We can let the thoughts arise and settle back in. And this is a key part of our instruction on shamatha meditation, that we're not trying to get rid of thoughts, and we're not following those thoughts. We may follow them for 5 minutes in meditation, but the moment we realize I've followed a thought, or the moment that thought arises, wherever in the process of a thought we catch it, that at that moment we can just drop it, let go, return to our breath, and let that thought go back as a wave back into the ocean, and just let it settle. And that, of course, is a key part of taking meditation off the cushion and into our daily lives. Because we may not be as watching as closely when we're in our daily lives and not on the cushion, but the exact same thing is happening. Thoughts are arising. We are choosing to believe them or not. We are choosing to follow them and work with them or not. When in reality, we can just let that thought go. Now, that thought could be a disturbing emotion. It could be a thought you've been having for decades that troubles you. It could be an instant reaction to something you see. But in any case, we have the ability, and meditation strengthens that muscle, that ability to just let that thought settle and just sit on the beach and relax, as it were. So right now, in this present moment, the entire past exists just as thoughts in your mind. And the entire future exists just as thoughts in your mind. And since we have the power to just let those thoughts arise and then settle back in, then we have the ability to just relax in the present moment. And in relaxing in the present moment, we move beyond distraction and we remain in the present, where there is no suffering. So that's the idea of how to move beyond distraction in our meditation. I hope this has been helpful, and it certainly has been for me. If or when our practice gets stuck, we can examine our attachment to the world, what our confidence level is in the teachings, and the degree to which we are allowing thoughts about the past and future derail us instead of letting our thoughts arise and fall naturally while remaining present in the present moment. This is something we can do for ourselves. It's something we can gradually develop and gradually grow in proficience at. Reminding ourselves again and again of the benefits of practicing meditation and the defects of not practicing it. So we have plenty of time for questions. We have a question microphone. If anyone would like to come up, the microphone is open for questions of any kind.
Hi. You did a good job on your first teaching, by the way.
Thank you.
I just, yeah. I just want to expand on something you said about our lives are not like a painting. Hmm. And I have a lot of trouble. Oh, crap. I think I lost my voice here. I have a lot of trouble of trying to make things happen now and structure, and they got to be perfect and everything's got to, you know. Mm-hmm. And I noticed during walking meditation that my breathing was off rhythm from my walking. My heart was off rhythm from my breathing. My thinking was off rhythm from everything. So it's like, every time we go to like a counselor or something, that they always say, "Oh, you're off. You're unbalanced, or you're off balance, or you need to find a balance. You need to. Everything must have a perfect rhythm, and everything don't have a perfect rhythm. You know, I mean, so we can't never. You know, we can just, I don't know what I'm trying to say with all this, but life isn't a still painting, you know.
Right.
It's more.
And if we're, honestly, if we're responsible for synchronizing our heart rate with our walking, we're in bad shape, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. I think, could you guys still hear me? Am I still coming through? Okay. I think if we are grasping, usually it seems that we're grasping after something that we want to stay exactly the way it is now.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot of my problem. I want things this.
Right.
Yeah.
Or we're grasping after an image of how we wish they were.
Yeah.
And really those are two sides of the same coin. Grasping after things the way they are is what we normally think of as attachment. And grasping after things the way we wish they were is what we call aversion. Because if you're grasping after something the way we wish it were, then we are expressing aversion to the way things are. And so there is a real fine balance between accepting things as they are without grasping for things to stay that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why I mentioned the fluidity, the fact that everything's moving. And if you find yourself suffering, you can ultimately look at it and say, am I grasping after things the way I want, you know, to stay the way they are? Or am I grasping after an ideal of something the way it is not?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure there's anything outside of those two. If there is, someone let me know.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
I've been like, I'm not really going to ask a question. I'm just.
Go for it.
I've been realizing like lately, you know, sometimes those Buddhist paintings where they show like the heads, mm-hmm. multiple heads on top. Mm-hmm. So I've been like experiencing that lately. Mm-hmm. Certain times during the day when I'm just regularly just being in the moment, it feel like in my mind, like it's a separation, like it's a, I don't know, I guess the best way to explain it is like it's something instead observing me in the moment, but it's still me, but it's like a higher level of awareness, but it's so strange because it really feel like my mind is kind of like, it's not bad, it's not like a negative heart pounding experience, but it seemed like it's gently like ripping the ego part of me apart from what I really am, and it's freaky kind of in a way, because mm-hmm. like I'm really just in this other spot, but I'm also tethered here, but it's like this mind is so different. I mean, it's not really different because it's tethered here, but when I start thinking about like how I'm an ape in a monkey body, just sitting here experiencing things in this world with this mind, you know, that's kind of fighting with the ego, animalistic mind, it's kind of a struggle day to day, I guess, in a way. Trying to, like, be interested in everyday, I guess, stuff, mundane things like talking. Now I just want to be quiet. I don't even want to say a lot of stuff now. I just want to shut up and just not say nothing.
So I have many thoughts going through my head. The first is to say that I think your experience, although it may be the way you describe it and the imagery you're using may not be common to everyone, I think it is quite common for people who start on a path to start to there's a different taste to the everyday world. It gets a little less attractive, and the things that our ego was clinging to now seem a little less important. And at times then, you can kind of step back and say, I'm disgusted with myself. Who is the me that's disgusted with myself, with my ego, right? And so there can be kind of that pulling in two kind of feeling. I would recommend, number one, that you, with experiences like these, you may want to talk to one of our lamas and explain the experience, and they probably have a lot more to say than I will. I will say that experiences in general often are signposts that our meditation is yielding results. And yet, just like you should not cling to a signpost as you're walking down the road, because then you're stuck right where that signpost is, you don't want to get too attached to any of the experiences that come about from practice. So you don't want to say, oh, this was pleasant, because the fact is those experiences tend to come and go, and it could be that that experience, that feeling goes away. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're not making progress. But if you've attached your confidence in your progress to that experience, then you might tend to get discouraged if you're unable to recreate that experience. Does that make sense?
All right.
So recognize it for what it is. It sounds like definitely a signpost of progress in the spiritual path, but understand it may not last, and don't cling to the feelings from that, and don't get discouraged if it goes away.
Okay.
But keep working.
Thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Marcus, thank you for your teaching today. My Yelp review is going to be 3 stars.
Right.
I'm just not as happy at the end of this as I expected. I'm just curious as to your thoughts going from the cushion into the daily life, especially with my situation. I'm assuming this is more frequent. We're in thought industries. We're challenged with keeping our businesses succeeding and growing. And so I've got 30 minutes a day where I'm quiet and focused on my thinking, or not, trying to let my thinking go, mm-hmm. and 9 to 10 hours where I'm in my head thinking about all the things that could go wrong and what I need to be doing to prevent that. So
you're training yourself.
I'm getting a lot more training in the wrong area on a daily basis. So, yeah. What?
I hear you. So what is helpful for me are these little moments of, they're not even meditation. They're just these moments of micro, let it settle. and then keep going, because we do operate in this world. We do operate in a context in which we need to use that thinking mind and those thoughts and that mind that plans for the future and that mind that remembers things that went on in the past so that we can apply those lessons to the future. We do need to operate that way. I think, though, that we're not trying to get rid of the actual operation of that mind. Because, yeah, you don't want to get bad at your job, right? But the emotions, the anxiety around that is definitely something we can work on. So if you see it that way, you actually see all those 10 hours spent at work in crisis mode as actual fodder for your practice, as actual what you can use to develop that meditation strength as you take those little moments to get a little separation and examine the attitude behind it without dropping it and trying to, you know, just behave as if you're unconcerned about the future in your work life, because that isn't going to work well for you. So does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good context. Thank you.
Thank you. That was my husband, so I'd be glad to give you some negative fodder if you need some more meditation materials. I'm good at that. Your talk just made me think of, recently I heard an interview with a Buddhist musician. They asked him what drew him to Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And he said what drew him to it was that everything's your fault. Mm. And just, you know, getting to that, like, you know, it's all because of what we are grasping toward, mm-hmm. How, you know, how we think the past should have been or how the future should go. Mm-hmm. And then I would like to ask you, so frequently when I counsel a person, I talk about the only time we get upset or dysregulated is when we don't get our plan A. Mm. And so navigating life is all about plan B. Like, how do you react when you get plan B? Mm-hmm. Does that feel like a similar thing to what you're talking about? Trying to be more okay with plan B's versus...
I definitely think so. I think in the ideal that our teachers have given us, they have such supple minds, right? Their minds are always fresh. So when our center burned down and the rest of us were shocked, Kempo Karte Rinpoche said, rebuild. You know, his mind was already moving on to the next step. They have such supple minds. So I definitely think that meditation gives us a suppleness to our mind so that when plan A doesn't work out, it's a much smoother transition to come to a point of acceptance of that. I like that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I love what you just said about the supple mind. It kind of, if I had a question, I'm not sure if this is a question or I just kind of want to ping you with mm-hmm. something, but it kind of answered what was on my mind. So I have this paradox showing up for me right now about attachment to my practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm really fortunate that I learned to meditate when I was a little kid, so I've had a lifelong practice. And I had a career as a professional dancer, and I'm a drummer now, so there are a lot of things in my life that I feel like I'm able to generally approach my life as a meditative practice. Mm. And then sometimes I kind of get hung up on this, like, I get in, you know, this sort of analysis paralysis, like, do I want to sit or do I want to play the drums or should I be, you know, I'm running my business and I'm approaching that as a meditative practice. And I kind of get in the opposite piece where it's like the practice itself brings me into, I realize that I'm experiencing that sort of, the thinking while you're meditating thing because I'm in a meditative experience, even though I'm not on the cushion. So I just kind of wanted to, that's been showing up a lot for me in my consciousness lately. And I wanted to kind of put that out there and ask about your take on that experience.
First of all, it sounds like you're very fortunate to have a structure that way. I would warn against, I guess, and I don't know your practice, just this is what came to mind. Yeah. I would warn against equating too much peace and a practice.
Okay.
The two can definitely go together, but you can become attached to peace from practice. There are practices that we do at times that are very active, very involved, and really challenging to us. And they don't always leave you feeling like you just meditated.
Yeah.
But they're powerful practices that work on taming our minds. So I would say drumming, dancing, things like that are wonder, you know, absolutely use everything in your life as meditatively as you can. Absolutely wouldn't say that. If you're finding, though, that you feel like those can take the place of your meditation, you might want to talk to one of our lamas about your meditation and maybe freshen it up and start going a little deeper with it. I don't know. That's just off the top of my head.
Yeah, actually, I love what you're kind of the reminder that, in this context, meditation, but any, really whatever practice we want to look at, that the rigor of the practice is separate from the result of the practice.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, anyone who's meditated for any length of time knows it. Like, we might get peace and we might not.
Right.
And that doesn't mean we suck at meditating.
Right.
It just means we are meditating.
Right. And yeah. If you're falling into that fallacy, then every time you don't get peace, you think you had a bad meditation.
Right. Yeah.
And, or you think you're a bad meditator, even worse. Right.
Right.
But the saying around here is the only bad meditation is the one you didn't do.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, one more, and this will be the last question.
Okay, so I was like back there thinking about another question. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about, she's talking about the illusion aspect of reality. So I understand that when we look at stuff, what we perceive isn't essentially correct in all aspects, and then our thoughts off of the environment aren't necessarily correct either, because if the environment that we see isn't correct with our eyes, then that means that the narration isn't necessarily correct either. So I realize that. So what exactly are we doing here? I mean, if you can understand, say you have suffering and then you look in the past and say, I had this suffering, now I understand that I can find peace, now that I have peace, what's the point of being here essentially and experiencing all this? Now, I know the whole stream of experience as you're going through the experience may not be peaceful, but again, like I said, after the fact, you can have a peaceful mind to understand why it happened, why the emotions arose, be an intellectual, I guess, on the situation. So essentially, since I've gotten past all that, I just want to understand what essentially is the point of being here if you can find peace and get past all the nonsense, basically. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, let me make sure I understand the question that you're asking.
Let me see if I can simplify it. So we got all this, you know, this stuff that causes suffering, right? Mm-hmm. And then we understand that we can get past suffering, right? Mm-hmm. And that suffering is our own fault. Mm-hmm. Now our ego, I guess, gives life meaning by what we go through. Mm-hmm. I guess it's okay. I'm kind of confused on that aspect of life too, but what I'm trying to get to is, if suffering isn't, you know, really essential, or if anything isn't essential, what's the point of being here if nothing is essential or lasting, or nothing ever is mm-hmm. continuous? What are we doing here? Like, what are we doing? And whatever. Just experiencing all this stuff when we could just let it go at any moment. Just.
Well, so there's a danger of chucking the whole thing.
And, because I like to experience. It is interesting.
Right.
It exists.
Right. So what we're after here, and what Bokar Rinpoche was talking about, that recognition of the nature of the mind. When we talk about the nature of the mind, we're talking about the true nature of the mind. And we're talking about that as opposed to the thoughts and emotions that arise in the mind, which are just appearances of the mind. What we usually experience are those thoughts and emotions. And yes, we say that there is a way beyond that. There's a way to experience the true nature of the mind, which is the union of awareness and emptiness or limitlessness. But we don't really, in and of ourselves, know the way out of that. And finding our way out of that without guidance is going to be extremely difficult. So I'd say the reason we're here is to help us wake up from that, to help us recognize it. Because even though we can intellectually, like you said, talk about how everything we're experiencing are just appearances, the truth is we don't live in that reality. We don't experience all of life as just being appearances. And until we do, we need to walk a path and get the instruction. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Does that help at all?
Yeah. And then I guess this is the last part of it. Mm-hmm. Emotion. How do people, because I know you could say it's an illusion, but I know people have literal emotional blockages inside of them that stop them from, you know, going along or progressing along a certain path. So how do you get past those certain emotional constructs that have, you know, that you built into yourself that you think make you as a person in the first place? How do you get past those constructs so you can make room for, I guess, a better persona or a better person?
I'm not sure I have the answer to that, because I'm not a trained counselor. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I have an answer for that. But I can say that a meditation practice would definitely support the exploration of that. But you might need to talk to a counselor about
it. Oh, no, that's not for me. I was just asking, just wondering.
Whoever.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't. There's a lot of talk. I think Lama Kathy's one of the first to say there's a place for counseling and psychological, professional psychological help in addition to meditation. And the two should not be seen as, or meditation should not be seen as taking the place of something like that. Does that help?
Makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. for sticking with this. And let's go ahead and dedicate the merit that we've gained by coming here and listening and contemplating. By this virtue, may our practice strengthen so that we may attain the state of Buddhahood and then lead every being without exception to that state. Thank you all.